What a great meal. Thank everybody for bringing the food. Great music, great fellowship. That's what the program's all about. Lorraine, I want to thank, I know we're not supposed to single people out, but Gary and Lorraine have really, Lorraine's done a lot of the work you see here, and a lot of the paperwork that she's responsible for, and she and Gary have really brought a lot of validity to our group and structure. I'm a fly-by-the-seat-of-the-pants guy, and Gary has to kind of, you know, and he's always about the traditions, and that's good. And they're involved. Their life is in service work in AA at the district level. And just thank y'all for what you bring to our group. And Lorraine's going to do, she's got something put to, Anal Annie has got something put together. No. She's going to go over something.
Thank you, I think. I'm Lorraine. I am an alcoholic. And I am very grateful to have found this group. It has saved me from going back into the black hole, which is my mind. We did a little tally tonight. I don't know how official it is. I'm sure I probably missed some people here on the sign-in list, but by my best efforts, we have 308 years and 7 months of sobriety in this room tonight. And by the way, I did not do this alone. Anything I did here was with God and with a lot of help from my friends in this room. So I'll turn it back over to Cole. Thank you.
All right. Any other announcements? There's a donation can over here for the traveling exhibit. And I think all we're trying to do is to defer is maybe gas expense. So if you get a chance and have enjoyed looking at the pictures, maybe drop a dollar or two in the can over there for the fella that bought that for us to enjoy this evening. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. This time I've asked Billy M. to come up and read how it works.
I'm Billy, I'm an alcoholic. How it works. Rarely we have seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are consciously incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorder. But many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go through any lengths to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideals, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has the power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures have availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked him his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve the conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry the message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaim, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description to the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostics, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we are alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if we were sober.
Jerry has asked that a portion of the big book be read by a good friend of ours, Kent. I'm going to have you come up and do that now.
I'm Kent Yates. I'm a very great recovering alcoholic. I've been asked to read a couple passages out of Vision to you. So you see, there were 3 alcoholics in that town who now felt that they had to give to others what they had found or to be sunk. A year and 6 months later, these 3 had succeeded with 7 more. Seeing much of each other, scarce an evening passed that someone's home did not shelter a little gathering of men and women happy in their release, and constantly thinking how they might present their discovery to some newcomer. In addition to these casual get-togethers, it became customary to set apart 1 night a week for a meeting to be attended by anyone or everyone interested in a spiritual way of life. Aside from fellowship and sociability, the prime object was to provide a time and place where new people might bring their problems. Many a man, yet days from this hospital experience, has stepped over to the threshold of that home into freedom. Many an alcoholic who entered there, came away with an answer. He succumbed to that gay crowd inside who laughed at their own misfortunes and understood his. Impressed by those who visited him at the hospital, he capitulated entirely when, later, in an upper room of the house, he heard the story of some man whose experience closely tallied with his own. The expression in the faces of the women, that indefinable something in the eyes of the men, the stimulating and electric atmosphere of the place, conspired to let him know that here was haven at last. The very practical approach to his problems, the absence of intolerance of any kind, the informality, the genuine democracy, the uncanny understanding which these people were irresistible. He and his wife would leave elated by the thought of what they could now do for some stricken acquaintances and his family. They knew they had a host of new friends. It seemed they had known these strangers always. They had seen miracles, and one was to come and one was to come to them. They had visioned the great reality, their loving and all-powerful Creator. I have to get a bigger book. Thank you.
My honor and privilege to introduce our speaker, AA speaker this evening, Jerry J. from the Lake Whitney Group. I love what you said, Billy, about having the purpose. And Jerry's known his purpose for over 30 years, and that's to fit himself to be of maximum service to God and his fellow man. I think he's done a damn good job of that. I sit here, I don't think it's a coincidence. Over, what, 30-something years ago, Bob White reached out his hand to you, and he's buried probably about 5 or 6 blocks from here. And that's a pretty neat deal. We go full circle, don't we? What a deal. But I respect Jerry. He's a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know many, I'm going to call you an old-timer, old-timers that are still committed to working with the newcomer like Jerry. I saw Josh do it, and I've watched Jerry do it now. At the newcomer's meetings, he just continues to work with the newcomer. And you never know that he has as long as he has in the program, because he's always willing just to reach out and help, just like he was taught to do by Bob White. But he's left a great legacy in Alcoholics Anonymous. You're a good man. You've been a good husband, a good father. I call you my friend. You're a mentor and my sponsor. And I want to come up and you to come up now and we'll give you a hug and get us out of here by 9 o'clock.
I don't know why I should try to screw that up anyway, do you? I'm Jerry Jones. I'm an alcoholic. Sober by the grace of God since January the 1st of 1973, for which I'm very grateful. You can tell that I am also the adult spouse of an Al-Anon. I want to thank you for having me. I want to thank you all for starting an AA group here in this community. I bring you greetings from the AA capital of the world, Lake Whitney, Texas. Bob White started that, and he did it in defense of some other smart intellects. One of them was Clancy, who's you've got a tape here of him, and some others were carrying him real high about how big his AA group was. They said they had more people serving coffee in their AA groups than he had in his whole group. And so Bob came back and made a bunch of photographs. He made him sign, got a sign painted that says AA Capital of the World. One of them's hanging in our meeting room there in Whitney. And he hung it around on the bank and on the post office. And everywhere it said, you know, Lake Whitney, First National Bank, AA Capital of the World. And I had it on the sign leading into city limits of Lake Whitney, AA Capital of the World. And then he mailed those photographs all over the country to all these people. And so we became the AA Capital of the World. And another good AA named, he had a little bad luck toward him, named Frank H. from out in Midland, Texas, who knew Bob real well, heard what he was doing. So he wrote him this letter. And I can't quote it exactly, but he said, you know, he heard about it and he thought this was really a pretty fine thing that Bob was doing, the way he was raising the reputation and everything of Whitney, Texas. And he really believed that if Bob kept on doing it, that one day Lake Whitney, Texas would reach the level of international acclaim of Blum, Texas. And I believe if y'all keep working your program and this group here, one day you'll get up to the level of Lake Whitney, Texas. Proud of you. Kent read the first description of one of the first AA groups in existence. And as he reads that, I can hardly read the thing myself because I get kind of choked up. It describes all the ingredients of a really great AA group. It describes a group of people who are consciously spending their time thinking about how they might help somebody else, how they might reach the newcomer. It talks about there being a total democracy, people laughing and having fun, welcoming newcomers, doing all kinds of really fine things for a lot of people. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. No one of us, no one person, is really carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. The message is God does for us what we can't do for ourselves. And I got that message one time. And, you know, I don't have any great talent or anything that I don't get anybody sober. But I am around sometimes, and I like to work with newcomers because I know more than... They're about the only people in the world that I know more about things than they do. They're dumber in post for the most part, and I, just like I was when I got here, didn't know what was going on with me. Didn't have any idea that I had an erroneous view of life. I had some old ideas that we talk about when we read How It Works. Those ideas dominated the way I thought, the way I reacted to the world. And they kept me miserable as hell for a long, long time. They made life very, very uncomfortable for me. So that when I was a young kid, just about time I went to college, and I was irresponsible and wild as hell because I'd been taught to be very responsible all the time, and when I could get away from my dad, I could get irresponsible, and I liked that. And I found alcohol. And alcohol helped me with irresponsibility. It helped me not care what you thought about me. I really didn't give a damn whether you liked what I was doing or not. I wasn't trying to impress you with anything at all. I was just running wild and having fun. And what I was really doing and what I continued to do for the next over 20 years was to try to chemically alter reality. And I don't care what kind of substance you're putting in your body. If it affects your mind and you like it, you're trying to chemically alter reality. And my reality wasn't that bad. You know, I was raised in a good family and hardworking folks. And, they all loved me. And, but I got off to a funny start in my head. I didn't know until I know more about myself today than I ever knew before. But when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know much about me. I'd glossed over a lot of things. I didn't know, for example, that I had fear. And when I got doing inventories, I skipped that part about fear. What the hell? I'm from West Texas. Men from West Texas are not fearful. We're not afraid. Well, of course we are. But I couldn't say it. I hated a lot of things. And I got to doing inventories, and I remembered that when I was in the first grade, I went to this little old country school, and there were three grades in each classroom. And we'd go out to recess, and a neighbor boy from across the section from my dad's place every day would throw me down and set on me. He was in third grade and I was in first grade. And I really didn't care a whole lot about that. That just kind of messed up my recess. And but I couldn't do anything about it because the teacher said we couldn't fight. And I had to please the teacher. And one day Howard threw me down and he tore my shirt. And I went home and my dad saw the torn shirt, and that was not a thing that we did a lot of, tearing up clothes. That was just not, we didn't like to buy a lot of clothes. And we wore them a long time and well. And he said, "What happened to your shirt?" I said, "Well, it wasn't my fault. Howard did that." He said, "Well, tell me about that." I said, "Well, he throws me down every day at recess and sits on me." And Dad said, "What do you do?" I said, "Nothing. I don't do nothing because the teacher says we ain't supposed to fight." He said, "Let me tell you something, cowboy. If I ever find out anybody's been throwing you around, sitting on you, and you don't come home with some skin off your knuckles, I'll give you a whipping like you never, ever will. Well, I didn't care a lot about going to school the next day. And I sure did hope Howard wasn't there, but he got on the bus with me, and so we rode the bus to school, and then I didn't care whether I went out to recess at all or not. I was just going to stay in the house, I thought, and the teacher ran me out. And so I went out there, and I thought, well, maybe Howard will forget it today. And I looked across the schoolyard, and Howard looked across at me, and here he came, just trotting over to go and take care of business right away, you know. And there I was. I hadn't done a damn thing wrong. Had done anything wrong. Didn't deserve this kind of treatment. Teacher's out there. She's going to give me trouble. Dad's at home. He's going to whip me if I don't fight him. Howard's bigger than I am. I don't know whether I can fight with him at all or not. Don't even want to try. I just want him to leave me alone. He comes toward me and I've got to make a decision. I've got three different pressures working on me. So when Howard got to be about 3 feet from me, I made my decision. I hit him right in the nose. And his nose bled, and he cried. And the teacher came out and snatched me up and was going to whip me. That was in days when they did that sort of thing in school. And I said, "Don't you whip me. My daddy told me to do that." And she knew my daddy, and she didn't whip me. And I learned a great lesson. And the lesson was you react the thing that you fear, react to the thing that you fear the most. That's what drives you. And I found fear drove me all through my life. I was afraid of a lot of things. I was afraid I wasn't a man, the kind of man that it took to get things done. I feared losing. I used to think I liked to win. I didn't like to win. I tried lawsuits for many years as a lawyer, and I know some of them that I won, but most of them I don't even remember. But I remember those I lost, because that, in effect, made me look bad, destroyed my self-esteem. People would not hire me if I was a loser. So I had a lot of things going on in my life, a lot of pressures on me that were internal. I had different things going on inside me that put an internal pressure on me. And alcohol helped with that. I could take a few drinks and I didn't give a damn about anything. I just didn't care. It was a little vacation from the reality of life, the way I saw it. But of course, it only lasted as long as the drug lasted. When the drug went away, I was right back where I was, and usually I'd done something else that I had to worry with. I was guilty of something. I'd forgotten something. Billy talked about blackouts. They were wonderful. I really enjoyed blackouts. And it was all part of the game when I just loved drinking. God, I loved to drink whiskey. And I liked what we did when we drank whiskey. And I'd wake up the next morning, we'd all be somewhere. We didn't know where. And we'd say, you know, the first question we'd ask is, "Where are we?" And then the next one was, "What do we do?" And we'd have to piece it together. And I thought that's what everybody did that drank whiskey. They didn't know where they were or what they'd done. And it was okay. But I was always the guy that wanted to do it again. Let's just do it again. What do you think? And I followed that pattern. Responsible, irresponsible. Responsible, irresponsible. Through a lot of years of my life, until I got through law school and got to Dallas and began to try to make a living for my family. Had a couple of kids. A wife that was just hypersensitive about alcohol. She has a thing about it. That's why I sent her to the psychiatrist. Because she overreacted bad about drinking, you know. And he told her, he said, "You ought to drink a little wine or something, you know, just drink a little." And I bought her all kinds of wine. My God, I bought her more bottles of wine than you ever sold. We had to give most of them away when I got sober, but we had a lot of wine around the house. I didn't like wine, but I wanted her to have it anytime she wanted it. And I kept having more trouble. And as I had trouble, I quit going to places where I had trouble. And I quit being around the people where I had trouble with. And when you do that for about 20 years, there's a lot of places in Dallas you just don't go anymore. And so I was wound up pretty much of a recluse. I worked because work was important. I had responsibility there that I had to discharge. I had to win. I had not to lose. I had to achieve, because that's what you were. If you weren't achieving something, you know, you were nothing. When they asked me what you did, you didn't think about anything except I'm a lawyer. And you start telling who you all the accomplishments you've got, and that's who you are. You're hiding behind all of those words that keep you away from who you really are. And I wound up a recluse drinking in my home. And my wife screwed that up. You heard how she did that. She got tired of going to the psychiatrist, and she started this damned Al-Anon thing. And she liked to ruin me with that Al-Anon thing. I had just made senior partner in the biggest law firm in Dallas when I found out that my wife was going to some kind of meetings that did not involve me. As far as I wasn't invited to go. And my daughter said she didn't know what they were. I was asking where her mother was, and she didn't. I don't know, Daddy. I don't know where she was. She may have gone to one of them meetings. What kind of meetings are those, Karen? Family meetings, Daddy. Oh, well, a lot of you know that I've said this many times, but we had decided that if our marriage didn't improve in 6 months, we were wiping it out. And if your wife is going to family meetings under those circumstances, and you're a lawyer, you think you probably ought to go to those damn meetings and find out what's going on. There's no telling what they're doing to you. There's no telling who's there. So she comes in, and I begin to cross-examine her, and she sounds just sweet and lovely and stand up there, but I want to tell you, that's the most difficult witness I've ever cross-examined. Where you been, Billy? Out. Out where? Preston Center. What did you do there? Met some friends. Who were they? You wouldn't know them. What did you do? Oh, we just shared our experience, strength, and hope. So I realized it's going to be a long night. We're going to have a hard time getting the full story here. So I start, when you cross-examine, you close doors where they can't go out that way, and you close this door, and you keep getting narrower and narrower. And finally, I got a word, and the word was Al-Anon. 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 What would be an Al-Anon? We were in a pretty heated argument by this point, and I didn't know what an Al-Anon was. I'd never heard that word, and I made my best guess. I thought it might be an aluminum kitchen utensil. It isn't. And when she started telling me what Al-Anon was, it was bad news. I thought maybe she'd gone to work or something selling utensils, but my God, here she was going to public meetings. For what purpose? Well, to learn to deal with a family member or friend who has a problem with alcohol. Ding! I am the ticket to Al-Anon. There's not another candidate for thousands of miles. I'm the only one. She has tried and convicted me of alcoholism, and I haven't even got to open my mouth. And this was serious. This was damn sure serious, because we, in that law firm that I was working for, we already had two alcoholics. And we didn't want any more alcoholics. I know, because I heard them talking about it. They were going to get rid of those two just as quick as they could. And they were senior people. They had a lot of clients. And hell, I'm just scratching, barely getting in the door, and she's going to these public meetings. I know she's telling them all about me. And I set her down in a chair, and I said, Billy, I want you to understand now, I'm going to talk to you very seriously about something. See, I'd sobered up almost instantly. I was pretty good buzz on when we started this conversation, but I'm sober now. I said, have you noticed I'm the only one that brings any money to this house? Yeah. Yeah, she knew that. I said, do you know that we owe money for the furniture, for the house, for the cars. We owe money on every damn thing that's here. Yeah. Yeah. Do you know what happens when they stop paying, when we stop paying for those things? No, what happens? They come and get them, really. They come and get them. They take them away. Now, Billy, we're not talking about educating our children now. We're talking about standing naked in the streets of Dallas with our children in the middle of the damn winter. Because when they find out downtown that you're going to those meetings and that you think I'm an alcoholic, they're going to fire me that day. The money stops. They come get all this stuff and we're on the street. Now, you got to stop going to them damn meetings. And she got that Al-Anon look on her face. And she said, I think I need to go to those meetings, Jerry. I said, Billy, please do not go to those meetings. And she said, Jerry, I think I'm going to go to those meetings. I said something loving like, Billy, if you go to another one and I find out about it, I'll kill you as sure as hell. And she went, and I didn't kill her. She drove me crazy. I'd never spent a day after that day when I didn't worry about whether they found out about, is this the day they're going to call me in and fire me? And if I got through that day, then I was on the way home, I was thinking, how can I get that damn woman out of Alabama? I just got to get her out of there. I got to find some way to get her out of there. And that broke through my little old ideas. That one bit of pressure there of her going to Al-Anon made a substantial change in my life. I became convinced I had to get her out of Al-Anon. Everything would be all right if I could just get her out of Al-Anon. And one night, I decided I'd pick a fight with her. Y'all probably never did anything like this, but I decide sometimes before I get home, we're going to have a fight tonight. And I'm going to get all the information and facts I can from her on my side of the argument before I ever let her know we're going to have a fight. So I go in, and she's cooking dinner, and I walk up behind her and give her a little kiss on the cheek. And I say, Billy, how was your day? She said, fine, fine. How are the kids? Oh, the kids are fine. Dog's doing all right. Yeah, dog's fine. Dog's fine. Billy, I've been thinking. You think I'm an alcoholic. Is that her? Still stirring the pot. She said, I don't know whether you are or not. I said, well, that's damn funny because you've called me an alcoholic for years. And she said, yes, but I was wrong. It doesn't matter what I think. It didn't make a nickel's worth of difference what I think. It didn't matter what your mother and father thinks. It didn't matter what your partners think. It didn't matter what your doctor thinks. It matters only what you think. Because if you don't think you have a drinking problem, you're never going to do anything about it. Now, this wasn't going exactly the way I thought it ought to be going. And I made a very basic mistake. No good trial lawyer ever asks a question in the middle of a situation like this when he doesn't know the answer. You've got to know the answer before you step out there. And I just blundered off and I said, well, if I wanted to find out if I was an alcoholic, how would I do it? And bam, the jaws of the Al-Anon trap closed just like that. She casually turned around and looked at me and said, well, I've read a book called The Primer on Alcoholism by a lady named Marty Mann, who was the first woman who came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And she says in that book, if you want to find out if you're an alcoholic, you should take a little test. Just drink 2 drinks a day, every day, for 6 months. And if you never exceed that 2-drink limit, you're not an alcoholic. I said, wait. Let's get this straight. You've been trying to get me to quit drinking for years. And are you telling me you want me to continue drinking now for 6 months? And she said, yes. And I realized I was dealing with a very sick woman now. this conversation was not going my way. It made no sense whatsoever. I said, that's the dumbest damn test I ever heard in my life. And I disengaged and went and sat in my chair and had a few drinks. And I had a few drinks for several days and thought about this thing. And being the responsible man that I was, I decided somebody's got to try to save this damn family. And it looks like it's going to be me. I'm going to have to do it. So I decided I'll take the damn test. Now this is where my recovery started. This is where I got my first step toward reality. I didn't have any idea that I would have any trouble passing that test. I knew I wouldn't really want to pass the test because, you know, that wasn't much to drink. But problem? No, there was no problem there. So I started taking the test. Well, I changed the test a little bit. I did. I had a pretty big glass, and I was going to drink three drinks. Just three drinks a day. I'm going to have two martinis, and then I'm going to have a brandy and soda. And then I'm going to switch to coffee. And I'm going to spend the rest of the night either drinking coffee or just relaxing. And nobody, except a prohibitionist, could fault a man for drinking like that. I kind of suspected she was in with a bunch of prohibitionists, is what I really thought. So I started trying to do that. Didn't tell her I'm taking the test. No, no, nobody knew I'm taking the test. Just me. I knew I was taking the test. And I started trying to take that damn test. And I'd get two drinks in me. And the cares of the day kind of began to slide off. And I'd get down toward the bottom of that second drink, about time to get through with martinis for the day, you know, and I think, well, it's about all the martinis today. And then it would happen. You know, our book says that alcoholism centers in the mind. I would have a thought. And the thought would be, what are you doing? What are you doing? Are you over 21? Are you a man? Who supports all these damn people around here? Who goes down and fights those other lawyers all day long and has those idiot judges that he's got to deal with? Present company accepted. Are you going to let a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes tell you how to drink whiskey? Hell no, I'd say. I'd go to the bar and drink the bottle. And I wake up the next morning and I wonder, why in the hell did I do that? Why did I do that? Or I could go to the bar after I'd had a hard day and I'd walk up and open the bar up and take a deep breath and think, you know, I've had a bad day. It's been a bad day. Ain't going to be no test today. No test today. I drink the damn bottle. Or I could forget it some days. I could forget to take the test. I think it's intentionally forgetting it. She told you what she did every morning when she woke up. The moment she awakened, she had this badass sponsor who told her to do these things to me. And just the minute she woke up, she'd say out loud and with great enthusiasm, "This is the day the Lord has made. I shall rejoice and be glad in it." Now, when you've had a quart of whiskey the night before, your eyes are stuck shut and you got the stuff growing on your tongue and you're shaking and your head's throbbing, you're reasonably sure you'll not rejoice that day. There's not going to be any rejoicing that day. I gave that test a fair shot. I ran it about a year and a half. Never passed it one time. My own test, my own number of drinks I'm going to have, a reasonable amount, and it drove me crazy. Why couldn't I do that? I had a lot of willpower. I'd done some pretty tough stuff that took some stick-to-itiveness to get through to. And I couldn't decide that I'm going to drink three drinks a day to get my wife out of that damn crazy organization she belongs to. And stay to it. Now, she didn't even know I was taking the damn test. I figured she'd notice it one day, and I probably wouldn't have to do it 6 months. She'd recognize in a couple of months that she was making a terrible mistake, that I was in control of everything. And she'd get out of Alamo, but she never had a chance. because I just kept drinking. And as a matter of fact, it seemed like I drank more when I'm trying to take the damn test than I did before, which made no sense to me. It broke through. That test broke through that mental defense that the alcoholic builds up. It's called denial. It's called rationalization. It's called justification. It's the thing that happened to me when I went to the hospital with a bleeding stomach. And they told me, they did all kinds of x-rays and stuff, and they couldn't find anything wrong with me. The doctor said, "Do you drink?" I said, "Yeah, I drink." "How much?" And I said, "Oh, I drink pretty good." And he said, "Well, you're going to have to quit drinking, because he said, you've got a stomach that's just irritated and it's just bleeding all the time. Not like an ulcer. It's just the whole stomach is raw." And I got to get out of that damn hospital real quick because I needed a drink. And I walked home, and the first thing I did when I walked in the house was mix a big drink. And Billy was watching me take that drink. I turned around. She had tears in her eyes. I said, "What in the hell's wrong with you?" And she said, "I can't hardly stand to watch you kill yourself." A little later, I went to another doctor. And that doctor told me one year, he said, "Your liver is really not doing well at all. How much are you drinking?" I said, "I drink enough." And he said, "Well, you're going to need to cut back, way back." He said, "Some people can drink, some people can't. You may be one of those who just can't. So just cut way back." I seen the next year, and he said, "Jerry, I've got to talk to you." He said, "That your liver function is off the chart." And he got the chart down and showed me where I was just way the hell out of bounds. He said, "Now what you're going to do is go home and not drink for 10 days and come back and we'll repeat this test." And I walked out of that doctor's office and knew absolutely that I was not going back. Why should I go back? I'm not going to quit drinking. If I quit drinking for 10 days and I'm better, you think he's going to tell me to start up again? Hell no. If I'm not getting any better and I haven't drank in 10 days, you think a guy's going to tell a guy who's got a bad liver problem, "You can drink all you want to"? No, he ain't going to say that. So I'm a dead loser on this deal. So I ain't going back. Now what kind of idiot are you when the doctor's telling you your liver function is off the chart and you're going to continue drinking? And we've all done things like that. We drank when it made no sense whatsoever to drink. But this damn test, over a year and a half, began to wear on me. And on December the 31st, 1972, there was only one thing I needed to do. I needed to end 1972, because I'd wore that year plumb out. I needed a new year, and I needed to stay sober while we went out to dinner with some friends. Going to come back to my house. I know why we're coming back to my house, because when I get out and get a few drinks, sometimes I don't want to go home. But we're going to come back to my house and we're going to all bring in the new year. It's going to be a wonderful occasion. And I can't argue with it. It's okay. It's a good idea. So that morning I started off, and you know, I needed just kind of a little drink to kind of loosen up a little. And Billy saw me at the bar. Took my first drink, and she said, remember now, we're going out this evening." "Oh, yeah, I got it. So I paced myself. I paid careful attention to the way I was drinking. I was not mad at anybody. I had no pressure on me that day. I had no reason at all that I couldn't just kind of coast into the evening with a nice buzz on, go out and have a little dinner. If I got drunk before midnight or at midnight, everybody else going to be drunk anyway. Who gave a damn? That's all I had to do. And I woke up and I was in my green chair. Billy was sitting across from me wearing her little robe and, you know, little rocker, reading her little books. They read lots of little books. And I looked out the window and it was pitch black, and I said, "Billy, shouldn't we be getting dressed to go to dinner?" She said, "Oh, Jerry, don't you know what time it is?" It was about 10:15. I passed out at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I had no excuses. And I was sick of me. I knew that my wife had to call those people and say, "We can't go out for dinner. And oh, by the way, you can't come over here after you get through eating either of those. And she, being a good Al-Anon, she probably thought Jerry's passed out in his chair. She didn't say that, but she didn't have to. That's what I assumed happened. And I got up and went to the bar and mixed myself a big drink. I wanted oblivion. I wanted out of here. And it worked. And the next morning I got up and sat on the side of that bed and remembered all that. And I thought to myself, you know, okay, it's January 1. What are you going to do this year? What are you going to do this year? You've been trying for a long time to pass that damn test. You can't get along without three damn drinks. You drink a bottle every day. You're drinking a quart of whiskey a day, easy. What are you going to do this year to make your life function? Can you continue to function this way? Are you going to be able to hold on to that job and that profession, doing what you're doing? It's getting harder and harder and harder, and it's pretty damn hard right now. What are your options? The only option I could think of that I hadn't tried was to stop drinking. Something I promised I would never, ever do. But that morning didn't seem like a real bad idea. So I took a shower and I went out and told Billy how sorry I was for messing up the evening before. And she was absolutely unimpressed with my apology. She didn't give a damn whether I was sorry or not. She just did whatever she was doing. And then I told her, I said, well, Billy, I'm going to try to quit drinking. And she was impressed. She wheeled around and she ran over to the bookcase and she grabbed a copy of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It just happened to be there in that bookcase. A copy of the little 24-hour-a-day book, and she came trotting over to me with them and she said, here, you may find these useful. Would you like for me to call somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous to come and talk with you? And I threw the books against the wall and said, hell no. I got myself in this damn mess, and if anybody gets me out, it'll be me. And you keep them damned AAs and that literature that you leave around the house and the kids and the dogs and everybody out of the way, because this ain't going to be pretty. I don't know whether I can do this at all or not, but by God, if it gets done, I'm going to do it. And she said something loving and Al-Anon like, you got it, and walked off. And I had it. I had my problem. I was aware of my problem. I had no way out of my problem that I could see, except to quit drinking. And I'm going to do that. And I don't know how it was when you quit drinking, but you'd think if you're doing something bad for yourself and you stopped, it'd start getting better, wouldn't it? Didn't happen in my house that way. I want to tell you, I sweat. I shook. I got real quick. I couldn't be in the right place. If I'm outside, I ought to be inside laying down. If I'm inside, I ought to be walking around outside. I'm moving and grooving. Just moving. And my stomach, everything in my body is calling out, you know, we forgot something, Clyde. Send it down here. We need a drink. We need a drink now. And I'm not going to drink now. We need a drink now. And it just stayed in my mind constantly. I needed a drink. I needed a drink. And the more I thought about quitting, the harder it was, it seemed like. And I got through that first day. And the second day, I came to the conclusion that I might do a little sneak reading in that literature she tried to give me. I knew she'd leave it laying around somewhere. So I ran in the kitchen when she wasn't there and grabbed that little 24-hour day book. I'm real sorry I didn't have time to read the big book, but I just didn't want to get caught reading any of that stuff. Because I told her I'm going to do this thing by myself. And I whipped it open, and January 2nd it said, alcohol has ruined your life. Yeah, you're damn right. So this year we're going to give our drinking problem to God and leave it there. I cannot tell you how disappointed I was in that. How are you going to give it to somebody you can't find? I've been looking for God ever since I'm a little old bitty boy. I've been to churches. I've been to revivals. I've been to the front numerous times. I've been sprinkled, dunked, all those things, and nothing had ever happened to me. I couldn't find this thing called God. Why? Why couldn't I find it? Because I conditioned it. I always conditioned it. Well, I'll do this, but then you've got to show me what you're going to do. If you show me your presence, if you show me you're really here, light a bush up, let me walk on a little water, like they talk in the Bible, and it's just one of those things, I will do everything you tell me to do. But it didn't happen. And I never told anybody about my disappointment. I just slowly and surely quit trying to find the power. And there I was with the biggest problem I've ever had in my life. Knowing I'm not doing well at all. And I don't know what to do, so I don't know why I did it, but I threw that little book out in the middle of the table and I said, God, if you're there, I'm going to give you this drinking problem. If you take it, I may do some more business with you. Good prayer for me. I mean it. I needed a drink just as bad before I said that prayer as I did after. I mean, just as bad after as I did before. Went to bed, didn't sleep, sweat, still quick. And I got up the next morning, but the next morning when I got up, I knew something that I didn't know when I went to bed. And that was that you are going to drink today unless you get some help. And you need some help with skin on it. And I knew I needed to find some people somewhere, and the only place I knew to go was this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want my wife to know I was going to do that. You know, God, I've resisted Alcoholics Anonymous for a couple of years, and now I'm going to turn myself in. I'm not going to her damn group, I'll tell you that. I'm not going to where she goes. She's told everybody about me there. I know she has. She has. She's poisoned the well, and I'm not going there. So I've got to find someplace else to go. So I looked in the telephone directory, and there was a Nana group, she said. So I thought, well, you know, that sounds kind of like maybe that's the head place. So I called up, and I got the most insensitive damn woman you ever got in your life. I mean, she didn't have any sympathy at all. I said, I'm having trouble stopping drinking. And she said, are you going to AA meetings? And I said, no, I haven't been to AA meetings. She said, well, you need to go to an AA meeting every night. I said, I'm an important lawyer, and I haven't got time to go to an AA meeting every night. And she said, well, what do you do in the evening? I said, well, I've been drinking. And she said, well, you're going to stop that so you'll have free time, won't you? I said, okay. Where am I going to go? And she said, well, where would you like to go? What kind of group would you like to go to? There are all kinds. And I said, well, I'd like to go to one with all college graduates. I'd like to have it near a country club. And she said, we ain't got none of them. So I said, well, what do you got? So we got it narrowed down to a little secret group, a little home group, where nobody could see me, because it was important that nobody see me. My partners were going to be just as upset for me going to AA meetings as they were for me drinking like an alcoholic. I knew that. I'm sure of that. They didn't want any AA members going around talking to their clients. So I picked this little group and I started going there. And they didn't impress me. Well, they impressed me, but I didn't think they really had much of a problem. Those guys had been sober for 15, 20 years. Hell, if you felt like I did, you couldn't stay sober 15 years. I mean, and their baby had a year and a half, and I couldn't think 2 weeks, you know. And I went to about three of those meetings. I'm just hanging on by my teeth, and they were nice people. But one night, the next night I went after about a month, and there was an old boy came in there from a treatment center. My God, he had literature sticking out of every pocket. He knew more about alcoholism than anybody I ever heard in my life, and he had 6 glorious months of sobriety. He just got out of treatment. He sat there and he just talked about alcoholism and recovery and all that stuff. He just amazed me, and the nicest thing about him was he was still quick. And he sat there, and he was quick, and I was quick. And we knew when we looked at each other that we were dealing with real alcoholics. I followed him right out the door, and I said, David, what do you think about this little AA and A group that we got right here? And he said, I don't think that's for us. I said, we need you to get in the middle of this thing. Why? Because we're going to have to change the way we think. People say they don't know how Alcoholics Anonymous works. But it's clear from the way the book is written and what the book says that Alcoholics Anonymous does something to us with the help of a power greater than ourselves. It helps us see life in a different way. It brings us into the great reality that Kent read about. It lets us see things as it really exists. We haven't been seeing it as it really exists. You can't flaunt your physical health the way I was and have all the evidence stacked up against you that this stuff was killing me and not go back to the doctor at all. Something's wrong with your perception of reality. And alcohol had got me way the hell out in the weeds. And I had to go, he said, someplace where they were going to change the way I thought. And we were going to have to do steps, and we were going to have sponsors, and we were going to clean ashtrays and wash coffee cups, and we were going to do all kinds of stuff that I couldn't imagine what in the hell good it would do. But he said, we're going to do that, and I said, okay, I'll go. Maybe. I had to check it out, and I cased the place that he told me about, like just like I was going to rob him some bitch. I went the next day. I drove past it about 60 miles an hour, glanced over my shoulder, and boom, down the road, you know, made the block, came back. It was over the top of a 7-Eleven store. And I pulled in there, and I looked up the windows, and there was no cameras up there. There was nobody standing up there snooping and pooping, you know. So I went in and got me a Slurpee or whatever it was, came back out, checked upstairs again, and still nobody was watching me. So I got in the car, and I backed up, and I noticed there was a driveway around the back of the place. So I drove around the back, and there it was. There were 6 places to park in the alley and a fire escape where I could climb the fire escape and go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's where you got me. And you got me resisting everything that you had to teach me, except the fact that I needed to quit drinking. I knew that. When you told me I was powerless over alcohol, I knew that was true. I'd run my own test on that. And if you can't get along with 3 drinks a day, how in the world are you going to get along on none? I was scared to death that I could not get away from the drug alcohol. But I didn't tell a damn soul that was my fear. I didn't want you to know that. And I went, and I didn't like what you did. I saw your funky little signs on the wall, your steps, Sunday school stuff. Here I am with an industrial grade problem, and you're teaching Sunday school classes to me. This ain't going to work. But there were people there who talked and sounded like they had a problem very, very similar to mine. And they were sober. You could tell they were sober. They were happy people. They were bizarre people. They were different kind of people than you'd ever see anywhere else in your whole life. They did things that you just wouldn't believe, that some guy'd stand up and tell some horrible damn thing about himself, and they'd all just laugh like hell. And I got thinking, well, I did a couple things that were kind of cute. I might tell them. And so I told them one, and they laughed, and they put their arms around me and said, look here, Jerry is beginning to open up. He's beginning to be himself. And you know that's all you can ever be. Nothing's added to you. The steps don't add anything to you. We discard things that keep us from needing something that chemically alters reality. We get in tune with reality, and we're able to live happy lives with whatever comes down the pike. But you've got to form a connection with this thing called God. A power greater than yourself. You don't even have to call it God. You can call it anything you want to. Call him Leroy. He don't care. Just know that there's a power greater than yourself. And I began to see in Alcoholics Anonymous people recovering that shouldn't be able to do it. I'm analytical as hell. I watch and study people. I'm cynical. I don't miss a damn thing when it comes to this kind of stuff. They're trying to sell me a bill of goods about this thing. I'm watching close. I really don't believe that little funky signs on the wall or what this is all about. There's something happening in the back room the big timers are back there, and they'll give you something to fix you. I don't know what it is, but they'll give you something. And they didn't do, never gave me anything. But I began to watch them, and I began to notice that there were people who were happy. They were getting along, their lives were being. And another thing, they didn't seem to care who I was. They didn't ask me what my profession was. They didn't ask me whether I had a swimming pool at my house. They didn't ask what kind of car I drove, how much money I made. Those conversations just never came up. Every cocktail party I ever been, they always talked about those things, but they didn't talk about that in our folks' novels. They asked me things like, have you got a sponsor? How you feeling? What step are you working on? And began to tell me about themselves. And I began to understand that I had to get bone honest with those people. If I was going to make this thing, I had to get down to the very most basic thing about myself. I didn't get there quickly. They talked about the four-step. Hell, I didn't want. I didn't need to be. I've been to a psychiatrist. I talked about football with a psychiatrist. Why should I need to write down a bunch of stuff that I'd just as soon forget? But I was in the middle of a bunch of, fanatics. If you had a headache, have you done a four-step? Got a hangnail. Have you done your four-step? Yes. Finally, I decided, well, let's do the damn thing and get it over with, so I did it. And I did a fair job, I guess, on it because I began to learn something about myself. I began to learn that something was blocking me. The book says something blocks us. From what? The power we need. Lack of power was our dilemma. Something is blocking me, and they said this thing is called self-centeredness. When I read across that page in the big book, the first time I read it, I skipped the rest of the page. Why should I read about your damn problems? I'm not selfish. I'm not self-centered. But then, because you shared your self-centeredness with me, I began to kind of pick up a little stuff. While I was running the test, about all I did was drink and watch TV. A boring life. It got so bad that I decided I had to find something to do besides watch TV. So I bought myself an aquarium. And I put the aquarium between my chair and the wall. It's my aquarium. I put the kind of gravel in it that I like. I put the kind of plants I like. I like pretty, graceful, leafy plants that kind of reach up to the surface of the water. I put the kind of fish in it I want. I want pretty, slow-swimming fish. I put a light on it. I could make it daylight, or I could make it dark, just as I chose. I fed my fish, if my fish were to be fed. Sometimes there was land of plenty, and sometimes there was a famine upon the land. And I loved watching my fish. God, I just could sit there and watch those fish glide around in that water, dream those dreams about what I was going to do, to that guy that did this to me. And, one night I was in a meeting, and some guy was talking about, well, they did all time talking about unmanageability. My life really wasn't unmanageable because I'd done pretty damn well. I'd done well. I could understand why some of you poor folks didn't do so well. You'd probably be unmanageable, but I was manageable. And selfishness and self-centeredness, I had a problem with that. I told you about that. And then that night, one of those old experiences broke through my memory. And I remembered my fish boat. There was always one damn fish. Generally a bowl clinger, an ugly fish. And he would get swimming around in there, and he'd go up to next to the prettiest fish in there and nip him on the tail. And the pretty fish would begin to swim away from him, and he would chase the pretty fish. And the first thing they know, they were encountering other fish, and the fish were just going back and forth in the bowl, and it just drove me crazy when they did that. And I'd reach out and slap the side of that bowl and just, bully! Let them know there was a power greater than they were that was unhappy with this damn what's going on in this bowl. And I gave them three claps of thunder to let them know the power was unhappy. And I came to know that there's some fish just don't catch on. So I bought me a dip net. And I'd catch the bad fish, and I'd pull him out of the, hold him on my lap until he got real still. Give him a hand-on experience with the power. And then I'd flip him back in the tank. Now, I'll just tell you this. If they float, you kept them out too long. And I think about putting my debt net on some people out there in life. If I had a child, I could get a couple of them out, you know. I gave him 3 debt net treatments. 3 claps of thunder, 3 debt net treatments. You'd know any self-respecting, intelligent fish would have caught on by now. But there are such unfortunates, they seem to have been born that way. So the 4th time I pulled them out of that bowl, I just take them to the toilet and flush them. Nobody knew a 41-year-old big-time lawyer was playing that game with fish. And that night it occurred to me, you know, I couldn't even run a fish boat. And I'm talking about my life being not unmanageable. I couldn't run a fish boat. And then it occurred to me, you know, how many 41-year-old men do you know that get upset by what fish are doing in a fish tank? Maybe that's self-centered. Maybe I'm taking this thing a little too personally. And with those kind of revelations, I suddenly realized I found self-centeredness everywhere in my life. Everything that happened was judged by how does it affect me? Is this good for me? Is it bad for me? Does it affect me? If it affects me, it's my business. And it should be done my way. And if it isn't done my way, I'm angry, I'm fearful. I've got all these different things that they talk about in that inventory. And that's where I found self-centeredness. And it was my job to find it, because no one can find self-centeredness in your life to make it any useful information except you. I can tell you what you're self-centered about, and it won't even dent the screen. But if you find it yourself, you know you got it, you know it's blocking you, and the only thing you can do is ask God to help you get rid of it. And you do it the way the steps tell you to do it. And you go to people and you straighten up what self-centeredness has caused. And you straighten out your life. An old AA member named Earl used to say, you stop doing what's bad, start doing what's right, your life will change. Your life will change. And you go to those people and you begin to treat them right. You clean off your side of the street. Sometimes it's not pleasant. Sometimes they don't like you. It doesn't really matter. When you have successfully done the 8th and 9th step, you will be able to go into any room in the world and sit down next to any person and be reasonably comfortable. You may not like them. They may not like you. But you've done your part. And that's something that most of the world doesn't do. Not all the world offends as many people as we do. But there's a hell of a lot of them that don't straighten it out as well as we do. And you begin to roll through your life and you think, God, you don't get through the steps first time. It's going to be, you know, it's like the Big Rock Candy Mountain, cigarette trees and soda water fountains. Everything's going to be just wonderful, isn't it? Isn't it? No, not so. Think life keeps coming at you. There's an expression that whenever the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And the teacher's life will give you all kinds of challenges. It'll give you divorces. It'll give you births. It'll give you deaths. It'll give you success in business. It'll give you failure in business. It'll give you all kinds of experiences that you have to process through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's really what the 3rd step is about, to me, is making a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I'm making a commitment that I'm going to process my life through those steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I do that, I have the conviction today that things are going to be okay. I once asked ministers, priests, rabbis, whatever, how do you get to believe in God? And they said, you have faith. Have you ever tried to have faith when you didn't have any? I've sat in chairs and decided I'm going to have it, and I just don't have it. But in programs of Alcoholics Anonymous, they say, we don't care whether you have faith or not. We don't care whether you think this thing works or not. We don't care whether you believe anything or not. What we ask you to do is just start doing what we tell you to do in these steps, and you will have an experience. You will have a spiritual awakening. You will have a an experience with a power greater than yourself. I'm just going to tell you one of them. Biggest one, I guess, maybe I ever had. My mother was big in my wife's life, and she was also very big in my life. We were three. I was the only kid, and we were at the 15-acre farm. Dad had arthritis, and I grew up early and had to do a lot of hard work, and she was right there beside me helping me all she could. And she was always on my side. She talked to me many, many times and told me that I was messing up my life with alcohol, that I was ruining my family. And in my drunkenness, I had to tell her, just mind your own damn business. I was doing the best I could. But she got cancer. And she got cancer before I stopped drinking. And I went up to see her. They had a surgery for her. And I went up there. And I wasn't going to drink on this trip because she died for 75 years of continuous sobriety. She never had a drink anywhere, anytime. And I went up there and I wasn't going to drink. And she had the surgery, and she had had cancer for a while, and this was the second surgery. The old family doctor was observing the surgery, and he came out and walked over to my dad and I and said, boys, it ain't no good. So that cancer's everywhere. It's on the kidneys, it's on the liver, it's everywhere. She won't last a year. And all that resolve I had about not drinking, that just disappeared. It's like somebody turned a switch on, and I just turned around, walked out of that hospital, and got in a car and went to a liquor store and bought a bottle of whiskey. And I stayed around for a day or two, drinking whiskey or vodka and coffee, and you know, playing like I was sober. But everybody knew. She knew. She got out of the recovery room, and she was conscious and she was aware, and she knew I was drunk. And they finally sent me home because I was of no value to anybody there. And I got, about 5 years later, I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got sober. The first thing I did in Alcoholics Anonymous, the first amend I ever made, was to mail my mother and dad a copy of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and told them that this is the way I'm going to try to live the rest of my life. And they just loved AA. They thought it was the best thing they ever saw. And we thought she had got that he used chemotherapy, and we thought she'd beat it. It looked like she had. She went to doctors and they said, you'll never have any more problems with this ovarian cancer. And then one day I got a call after I'd been sober about 5 years, and she said they found another big lump in the stomach area. They're going to have to operate again. Would you come up? I said, oh, you bet. So I went up there, and it was easy now. You know? We didn't have any issues between us anywhere. I was living the kind of life they wanted their son to live, the kind that they had raised me to be. And my dad was there, and he was worried as hell, and the family was gathered around, and mother and I had a long visit when I just got there, and she turned to me, and she said, Jerry, get the family in here, we'll talk to them. So I got them all in there, and she said, folks, I've had cancer for a long time now, and this ain't going to be easy. I'm a lot older, a lot tireder, and a lot weaker than I ever was before. I'm going to try my best to make it through this thing, but it ain't going to be easy. And it's not going to be easy on you either. It's going to be a hard fight. It's going to be hard on all of us. And while this is going on, lean on Jerry. He'll be your strength. And it was. She lasted about 2 weeks after the surgery, and that 2 weeks was just hell. I watched her just out of her head and hurting, and it was not a good thing at all. My dad just he had a horrible, horrible time with all that. And we finally both were driving home about 4 o'clock in the morning. And I said, Dad, you know, I did something tonight that I need to tell you about. I prayed God would take Mom. I think she's had enough. He said, I did the same thing. She died within an hour of that time. Now, the interesting thing about that is, same woman, same mother, same son, same disease, same situation. Never once in those 2 weeks while she was dying did I ever even think about taking the drink. Not once. My dad blew a big ulcer and they had to take out most of his stomach. He didn't get to go to the funeral. I had to arrange for his operation and do all that stuff. Never one time did it seem like it was necessary or appropriate for me to have a drink. I didn't need relief. I had been blessed with a power greater than myself that would handle whatever came down the pike for me. And it's always been that way for me. Whatever comes down the pike, I believe there's nothing God and I can't handle. Y'all are, Billy said tonight that I'd helped a lot of people. All I've ever done is share with people what's happened to me. And I didn't do any of this. I was doing the best I could back there trying to take that test. And I wasn't making it. I was doing the best I could. And I was working it every day. And it wasn't casual and it wasn't funny and I'd gotten over the idea that there was ever going to be a good time again. But I was going to try to finish it out the best way I could. And I couldn't go any further. There's a power that works through us. Lois Wilson, who's Bill Wilson's wife, you see a photograph of her over there. She was in her deathbed in New York, and the guy that was general manager of the Alcoholics Anonymous office in New York heard that she was in her last illness. She was in intensive care. He decided somebody ought to go thank Lois. She was the last surviving member of the four people. And thank her for what she'd done for Alcoholics Anonymous. So he went and talked to her for a little while. She couldn't talk. She had a little pad that she could write little notes on. And he said, Lois, I came today. I know you haven't got, you don't feel like listening to me talk a long time, but I came here for one reason, and that's to thank you for helping save our lives. And she grabbed her little pad and wrote, not me, God. He said, you got me, Lois. That's exactly correct. I know that. I knew that. But Lois, you were the messenger. And she picked up her pad again and wrote, and so are you. So are you. The Meridian Group of Alcoholics Anonymous is a foothold of sobriety that can grow and prosper. If you work at it the same way that the group we read about today in A Vision for You are doing, you keep in mind what you can do for the other fellow. If you keep trying to find people, hunt drunks. Hunt them. There's plenty of them around you. I'm just sure of that. And don't worry about whether you mess them up or not. You can't screw them up. Drunks are already screwed up. Get them in here and let them share your life and see what you've been given, and they'll respond to that. If they respond to anything at all, ever, you have the key to do it. God bless.
Wow, what a good evening. Thank you, Jerry J. Billy. Thank everybody for being here. Who wants to do this? Margaret, get the chips over there. We're going to do chips and pray and smoke. All right.
My My name is Margaret. I'm a child of God recovering from alcohol, and I'm very grateful to be here tonight.
Hi, Margaret.
What a glorious day this is. We have a chip system. Do we have anyone here that has a year or more of continuous sobriety? Okay. 9 months? 6 months? 90 days? 60 days? 30 days? Would anyone like a desired chip? Where are they? For 24 hours a day to try our way of life? Okay. You what?
Any other announcements? Anybody? Let's start the left.